Thank you very much. These two ladies are two of our newest committee members, so if you're wondering how you get up here and do a little reading or something, come to our committee. We meet on the, what, the third Monday of every month except December, and so it's normally a minute run, about an hour or so. Rhonda runs a very tight schedule on those meetings, so we're in and out and get all the business, so it's a whole lot of fun too. So hope you, if you'd like to join us, I'm sure with the third Monday of June, we'll be there. We meet at the Alano Club in the middle room, 7 o'clock, so hope you can join us. Okay. Now, our speaker here, actually the flyer says that he's from Billings, and he's actually from Huntley. And actually there's another guy from Huntley that's a good friend of ours. He's actually a friend of Bob's. So a friend of Bob's from Huntley. A lot of you know Cowboy Bob that has been here and talked a couple times and kind of showed up at every darn St. Cloud round for almost a decade or something like that. So he almost literally came off here just to kind of keep this guy in line. Or maybe it was the other way around. I can't remember how they said it or not. But anyway, and I kind of thought, my goodness, this guy drives all 2 days here and 2 days back to come and give his evening to us right here. And then when they pulled up in the driveway today, it was Wes Lita that was driving, so he just got chauffeured for 2 days, out 2 days back. So I think it wasn't quite right, but that's how this guy operates right there. But anyway, now I met, Don the first time up, oddly enough, at a AA regional forum up in Calgary, oddly enough. I think that's where it was, when he came up with Bob, if I recall correctly. Wasn't it in Calgary? I think that's where it was. And now I got to tell you, I hadn't really known him, heard about him from Bob, but that first evening there just cemented that this guy is a guy I'd like to have around me. We had some meetings there, and then it got to close of the evening, and we were at this hotel, and the restaurant was going to be closed in a little while. He suggested getting some ice cream. Well, me, just to be nice to Don, I figured, okay, yeah. I'll go. I'll suffer if I have to, but altruistically, I'm going to go and have a bowl or two of ice cream. And so we get there, and now this is where you got to fall in love with the guy, at least where I come from, is he literally says, give us two at a time. And so just like he was at the bar, he literally ordered two up right from the start right there, and I think we got a second round before the last call for the ice cream. And he bought, so I mean, that's it. I have a lifetime friendship. Wherever this guy's going, I'm going to be there, literally. So just a phenomenal individual. And actually, then he found a wonderful lady that they're going to be married, I think, 4 years coming up this August, something like this. The lady that's his literally his chauffeur here and back. And we were just out in Billings, actually, this March, actually. And now here's where I know he picked the right lady. Is they invited us over to have coffee, and guess what? I guess they wanted some ice cream. And not only that, they asked what flavor we wanted when we were going to come on over there. So sure enough, we showed up, and you know, you can only guess maybe what flavor we more than likely had there. Chocolate chip. Thank you, everyone. And so we just had a chance to spend a little time with Wes Lita. And before you leave tonight, you got to come up and meet this absolutely dynamite, wonderful lady. I mean, there is just, what a sweetheart. Don knows how to pick them. So he's a lucky guy. And without further ado, I want you to help me welcome Don.
Well, my name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic. It's great to be here. I think I spoke here 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. A lot of places I went 4 years ago, they never asked me back. But I was thinking today when I was really drinking, I spent most of my money on beer and women, and the rest I just wasted. But seriously, I've had this great opportunity to lead two completely, entirely different lives. My first life ended on March 5th in 1978. That's when I took my last drink. There wasn't much left. I went into a detox center then. My friend, Mr. Alcohol, had turned and become the worst enemy you could possibly imagine. About 2 years before that, a doctor told me if I didn't stop drinking, I'd be dead in 2 years. And being a good alcoholic brain, I thought, well, he did say 2 years, I don't have to hurry into this. So I drank for another year and 9 months. I pushed that envelope just about as far as you possibly could. I was oh, at least 40 pounds underweight, and the bank is in the process of foreclosing on me, and my life had really had gone down the tubes. My great friend, Mr. Alcohol, had become the worst enemy you could imagine, and I couldn't imagine why it had turned on me, because it was such a great friend to me for so long, so many years. I'm a kid. I was born way out south of Billings, Montana, in the cane brakes out in the hills, and I'm a hillbilly all the way. I truly am. I was 4 years old before I figured out my name wasn't Git Wood. I went to this little country school out there, and this was during World War II, and they couldn't get any good teachers because the teachers all quit and moved to the coast to work in the defense plants. They could make way more money. And so my folks and the other parents, they'd get together once a year. A couple of parents would go in and hire some old retired lady to come out and try to keep track of us little heathens. And there were six kids in the whole school. We had to ride our horses to get there. And the little teachers were more babysitters than they were teachers. And hell, I was very slow in school. I'm left-handed. And as being left-handed, I'm dyslexic. Most left-handed people are. That is like, sometimes you look at, like my name, D-O-N, I'd write it down N-O-D. The same with telephone numbers today, I have to be careful, or I'll write the number wrong. And so I had a real handicap there. They didn't even know what dyslexia was back then. But I'm so left-handed that if I break my left arm, I'm going to go blind. Because I'm going to stab myself in the eye with a fork trying to eat right in. But I had a terrible time in school. I couldn't read. The letters were backwards, and the same with the addition and subtraction. I wasn't any good at that, and I really had a rough time. I was in the third grade so many years, and one day they kicked me out of school because I forgot to shave. I got to the fifth grade, I quit school because my dad was still in the sixth grade, and I didn't want to pass it. But when I was going to be in the fourth grade, we moved over to the little town of Ballantyne, Montana, and I went down to that school, and there were, oh, I suppose 50 kids in that school. I never saw so many people in one bunch. And I could barely print a little on account of this dyslexia. I add and subtract a little. The other kids were writing and multiplication and division, and I was always the dumbest one in the class. And back then, they didn't hold you back. They just push you on through to make room for somebody who could learn. And that's the way I went through till I got out of high school. I was just getting shoved through. But when I was about 11 years old, I stole a can of beer from my dad and crawled off in the weeds and drank it. My God, what a change. That was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. That beer hit my stomach, and man, that wonderful glow came over me, and I was one of the guys. And that's when I started, my life revolved around alcohol. That's all I thought about. In high school, if the other kids would sip a beer, I'd just gulp them down. And I, as much as I drank, I never ever got as much to drink as I wanted. It seemed like. I always got more than I could handle, it seemed like, but I never got as much as I wanted. And there was one other kid in the school that was like me, and we were the party boys. And we graduated together, and he went in the Army, and he came out a couple years later. We were both 21 then, and we rented a house in Billings. We had jobs in town, and I don't know how we held our jobs. We were drunk every Wednesday night, Friday night, Saturday night. We kind of sober up on Sunday, and we were just really partying. That's all we were doing, and that went on for about a year, and he met this neat lady, and he married her. I was his best man. A couple years later, they had a boy. When that boy was 2 years old, this guy was doing pretty good. He worked for the REA back there, and he was buying some property and subdividing it, and he was getting his life straightened around pretty good, but he took on some beer one night and hit a semi and got killed and left his wife and this two-year-old baby. And about 35 years later, his mother passed away. And they asked me to be a pallbearer for her. And we carried that coffin to the grave, and in that family lost their plot. We set the casket down, they asked us to back up a little, so we did. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw something. I looked, and it was this guy's son standing at his father's grave, the father he never, ever got to know. And that's just what alcohol will do to you, or what it will do to an alcoholic. It will just literally destroy lives. It's absolutely horrible what can happen to it on account of alcohol. But I rationalized that it wouldn't happen to me because this guy always drove real fast. I never drove fast. Nothing will ever happen to me like that. Well, I went along until the inevitable happened. I got a DUI. And that wasn't too tough. I spent a night in jail and a couple $100. They took my license. I don't care. We need a license anyway, I guess. So I went along and three or four years later, I got picked another DUI. That one wasn't quite so much fun. I tried to whip a cop and that didn't work. They put the cuffs on me, threw me in the car and called me into the jail, took the cuffs off me. There was an old night sergeant behind the desk there, and he was giving me a bunch of orders. And I thought, I know I couldn't whip that young cop, but I know I could whip that old dude. So I made a great charge and kicked over a water cooler and a typewriter, and he just hollered, "Take him down," and those boys took me down. They took their billy clubs and they really thumped on me. When they got done with me, boys, I mean to tell you, I was broke, and I was broke gentle. I trotted right along behind them, yes sir and no sir, no more. They took all the tough out of me. And I had to go to jail for about 5 days. It was in the springtime, it was nice, and I'm sitting in this jail, and I'm thinking, every single time I got in trouble, I've been drinking. If I can just control this drinking some way. And I was trying to cut a deal with God. If he'd get me out of jail, I promised. And I meant every word of it that I would never touch another beer. Well, I got out of jail. I had to walk about 7 blocks to get to my pickup, and I had to walk by a bar. And I thought, well, one beer for the last one I'll ever drink. Yeah. And I was right back on it again. And my life just kept going like that. I could quit, but I just could not stay quit, you know. I quit for 10 months one time, and everybody was glad I went back. They couldn't stand to be around me. They might be better drunk than when I was sober. And I didn't know what to do. It was just, my life was just spinning out of control. And I've watched so many people way back then, friends of mine. One guy had two sons, and one of them, his youngest son, hung himself on account of alcohol. And his oldest son is retired out of the Army, and he lives in a basement now. And every day a cab stops there, and the driver gets out and hands him a case of beer and a jug of whiskey. He pays him off and crawls down his basement, just lays down there and watches TV and drinks and passes out. And comes to, he's been to AA, he can't get the program, he's not serious about it, and I don't see how he can live much longer. And I had another good friend, had a young kid, a real nice young boy. He got in a car wreck in Alaska, and he's in jail down in Colorado now. He's like got a 30-year sentence or something. He hit another car head-on and killed a guy in it. That's what alcohol does. I'm fortunate I didn't kill anybody, or at least that I know of I didn't. I can't say for sure. I'd come home and a lot of mornings ran out and checked my car or my pickup to see that with the grill, if there's something in there, anything bent up or anything. One morning I checked it and it was nothing. I opened the door, there was a case of beer on the seat, and I thought, man, I don't even remember getting that beer, but that's a great find, so I didn't like it. But I got to the point where I didn't even want to be around people when I was drinking. I just would rather be alone. And I was so miserable. One night I was in the bar, and there was, I don't know, 30, 40 people in there. They were dancing and laughing and jukebox going. And I just told the bartender, give me a case of beer and a couple packs of cigarettes. And I'd just drive the back road just be by myself. One night I was sitting home alone with a case of beer in my lap and the radio turning down low, and it was that old country music and old Hank Williams, not Hank Williams Jr., but Hank, you remember him, you can nod your head. He was singing, "I'm so lonesome I could cry." And man, the dam busted. The tears just poured out of me. I was so miserable. I didn't know what to do. I knew I was going to die if I didn't stop, and I knew I couldn't stop. And I didn't want to commit suicide. I didn't know where to go or what in the world to do. And I met my first wife, and went with her quite a while, and we got married, and I thought, by golly, I know darn right well I can quit now. I've got a wife, I've got responsibilities, and this will work out. We lived about 20 miles out of Billings. We'd go into Billings to do our business, and then on the way home, there was a bar about 3.5 miles from home. I'd always pull in there, and she'd come in with me, and I'd order a beer, and she'd have a cup of coffee, and I'd keep drinking beer, and she'd keep drinking coffee till I got the right amount of beer, and then she'd haul me home. And that went on. I thought, I was getting her pretty well trained. The wife's supposed to do that. Boy, she's giving me the evil eye. One evening we went in there, and I had my beer, and she drank her coffee, and I ordered another beer, and she just got up and said, "I'm going home." And out the door she went, and I couldn't imagine what in the world was going on. I went outside, and I said, "Well, what's the matter?" She said, "Nothing. I'm just not going to sit here and watch you get drunk." And then she quit lying for me. I was in bed one morning, and somebody called, and she said, "I don't know, he's laying in bed drunk." I couldn't imagine what in the world was going on. I just flat couldn't. I got to checking around, and I found out she was going to Al-Anon. And I didn't know a thing about Al-Anon. I thought they must be a bunch of communists or something. I didn't know what the world was happening. But she would not cover up for me anymore. She just absolutely refused to. And boy, things were going from bad to worse with our marriage, and she went out to Oregon to see her kids. And I thought, she's not going to come back. I didn't imagine she would. I thought, I'll get a letter in the mail from a lawyer probably wanting a divorce settlement of some sorts. And by golly, she called me on the phone and said she wanted to come home. I said, okay. She asked me if I'd go up to the airport and get her. I said, sure. And it was in the wintertime. It was real icy. And the last thing she said to me, "Would you please be sober?" And God, that made me mad. How dare her suggest I wouldn't be awful. So I went in kind of early on account of the roads were so icy, and stopped at the bar in Billings and drank for about an hour. And I had plenty of time and went to the airport. The greatest thing that could happen for an alcoholic did happen. Her plane was delayed for 3 hours on account of the weather. So I, of course, got drunk. For 3 hours, I staggered out and checked the schedule. It was delayed for another hour. The time the plane came, I was completely wasted. And only thing I can remember, they had these big, huge cement pillars in that airport, and I was propped up against one of them, and I saw her coming towards me, and the only thing I can remember is the hurt on her face. She was so hurt that I wouldn't stay sober, just to come and get her. And they couldn't find her baggage, and I was trying to pick a fight with a Delta employee there. And finally, I got the baggage, and I went out and fell down the middle of the street on the ice, and I couldn't get up. I fall down, and suitcases were flopping around, and everybody was hollering, "Get the dumb drunk out of the way." And she was so embarrassed, she finally had to go drag me out of the way, then come back, get her suitcases, and get them out of there. We got in the car, and she was livid with me, and I kept trying to tell her it was not my fault. If that airplane had been on time, wasn't my fault if the weather closed in. I was innocent. My life was just going out of control further and further, and she left again, and this time I knew she was not coming back. Not then she did, but I didn't know it. And she got a hold of my brother, And they slipped over to my house before I could get out of there one morning, and they just sat me down and just told me that you're a full-blown alcoholic, and you better do something, you're not going to live long. They want me to go to treatment, and I said, I can't go to treatment, I've got a bunch of cows I got to take care of, but I will go into detox for a couple days and get sober, and I promise I'll go to AA meetings. So they said, okay. So my brother took off to feed my cows, my wife went to get my suitcase packed, and I thought, well, I only got one drink left. I had about that much left in a half a pint. I had two cans of beer, and I chugged that down and went into the treatment center, the detox center. And I was absolutely horrified when I got in there. I was just terrified. I didn't know what was going to happen, and I knew I was down, way down deep in the pit of my stomach. I knew that this was my last chance to stay sober. If I didn't do it this time, I was going to be done. I just knew it. I got in there, and like I say, I had that much to drink, and I was kind of wandering around, and I went in this room. There was two beds in there, but I was the only guy in the room, and I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I just started crying, and I couldn't stop, and I just cried and cried. I was so miserable, and I wanted to pray, and I didn't know how. Finally, I just asked God to please remove this compulsion to drink. And they wanted me to eat some supper that night. I couldn't even think about eating. I couldn't drink coffee. The only thing I could do was smoke cigarettes and take tiny sips of water. It's the only thing I could keep down. Thank God I could keep cigarettes around. All right. They smoke them. But the next morning, it had been 24 hours without a drink. But I've never ever hurt so bad in my life. I never craved a drink so bad in my life as I did that morning. I'm so thankful I was locked up in that detox center. I know I'd have got a drink. Without a doubt I would have. I'd have been right back where I had started. And at noon, or about 11 o'clock, this counselor came in, and he said he wanted to talk to me. And so we went in his office, and we were talking, and he told me his story. He was a school bus driver. He took a busload of kids to a basketball game, and when they got off the bus, all the kids gave him their money. And he went over town, loaded the bus full of booze. And he drove a bus home in a blackout full of kids and booze. And they were all drunk, kids and him and everything. Next morning he woke up, he was laying on the couch, and he jumped up and hollered at his wife, where's the bus at? She said, it's outside. He went outside and there wasn't a scratch on it or anything. But it scared him so bad, that's what it took for him to get into AA. And he became a counselor after he got in there. And he told me that morning at 11 o'clock, he said, go upstairs to, I don't remember what room number it was, but he said, there's an AA meeting, I want you to go to that. This was my very first AA meeting I'd ever been to. I went up there, there was about 20 people standing there, and I looked them all over, and I, of course, to see if anybody knew me, and was nobody there I knew, and I thank God for that. I went and sat in the far corner, and I thought, maybe they won't even see me. Well, the doggone gal was chairing a meeting, spotted me. She said, we got a newcomer, would you like to tell us your name? And I thought, hell no, I don't want to tell you. But I thought, I think you've got to say your name, and I think you've got to say you're an alcoholic, and they threw you out of here. So I said my name and mumbled that I was an alcoholic, and they all yelled, hi, Don, and I had a heart attack. I don't remember anything about the meeting, except I was trying to control my tears. I was having an awful hard time with that. And I got out of the meeting and went downstairs, and on the table there was a bowl of soup and a sandwich. And this nurse came out of her little room, and she said, that soup and sandwich is for you. And I said, well, I'll eat a little tonight. She said, no, you won't. You're going to eat some now, or you're going in the hospital on IVs. You haven't eaten for 24 hours that we know of. And I said, now, just a damn minute. I am not going to eat your sandwich or your soup, and I'm darn sure not going to go in the hospital. She said, you listen, you're in my world now. My way. I didn't even know if I could eat. I ate three bites out of the sandwich and four tablespoons of soup, and that's the first solid food I'd had for probably a month, and it stayed down. I couldn't believe it. And that's how I got into AA. I went back to there about three, four nights a week for a month, And the counselor got me aside and he said, "Which outside meetings are you going to?" And I said, "Well, no, none. I'm just coming here." Well, he said, "You can't come here the rest of your life. You got to go to some outside meetings." So they gave me a list of the outside meetings. I went to one called 204 Grand Avenue. Went up there. Same thing. I kind of tried to hide in the corner and called on this one guy. His AA name was Old Tom. He jumped up and he said, "I'm Old Tom, I'm a grateful alcoholic." I thought to myself, "Yeah, and you're brain damaged too." Well, man, there's no such a thing as a grateful alcoholic. Can't be. But he did his talk and sat down, and I didn't get much out of that meeting, so I went to a different meeting the next time. And before I had this real bad drinking problem, I'd gone to auctioneer school and I did quite a little auctioneering. And this one other auctioneer and I sold a lot of sales together. And here I am at this meeting trying to hide, and the guy chairing the meeting says, "Come on in, Johnny," and close the door, ready to start. Here with my auctioneer friend. Now, I was so embarrassed. I just about, oh God, I didn't want anybody to know me to be there. After the meeting, he says, "Let's fill our coffee cups and talk a while." And I said, "Well, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know what to do." He says, "Why are you embarrassed?" I said, "Well, you're seeing me at an AA meeting." He says, "What the hell do you think I'm doing here?"
Yeah.
The only difference between you and me is I got about 4 months more than you do. That helped a little. He really tried to get me into the steps and get me to going on the program, and I wouldn't do it. He kind of, I was going to use him as a sponsor, and I don't think I'd like him. He's too pushy. So, got another friend of mine that was in there, and I asked him to be my sponsor. He sponsored me for about 6 months, and doggone him, he went back out and drank, and he didn't live long. And I didn't have a sponsor for quite a while, and this Johnny got on me again. He said, "You know, you're going to have to get on these steps." I said, "John, I'm working on the first three." And I said, "I'll do the first three and the last three, but the six in the middle I will not touch. That ninth step, I will never take a ninth step, ever." And he just shook his head and walked off. And he left the country, and so I didn't care. I didn't have a sponsor. I went to, half a dozen meetings a year, something like that. But I was sober, and I thought, gee, that should account for something. I'm not drunk all the time. But I was sober 3.5 years. One morning, my wife left again, and she moved out with her kids to Oregon. And I couldn't imagine why she didn't want to stay. I was sober for 3.5 years. What's wrong with her? Well, she couldn't stand me. I was so miserable to be around. I was just terrible to be around, and mad all the doggone time. And I was sitting there home one morning, and she was gone. I thought, yeah, I wonder if suicide maybe isn't the answer. I'm 3.5 years sober and thinking about suicide. That's what the disease will do to you if you're not working a program of some sorts. Well, I didn't have to worry about it, because about an hour later, a little white Ford pickup drove in the yard. I knew the guy that owned it was a guy that was married to my cousin. They were getting divorced on account of his alcoholism. And he came in the house and he sat there drinking coffee, and then he didn't, I kept wondering why he came out there. Finally he told me, he says, "Well, I'm going to AA meetings." And I said, "Well, great," because I knew he had a bad problem. Nothing wrong with me, I'm just an hour ago thinking about shooting myself. But he said, asked me if I'd come into a meeting on a Monday night for him. Because I said, "Sure, I'll go. I'm this great guy, I'll help him out." So I met him in there, and we go into this place. It's called the Downtowners Group, there in Billings. And doggone, there's that Old Tom sitting there again. And they call on him again, and he jumps up and says, "I'm Old Tom, I'm a grateful alcoholic." And I thought, brain dead, old idiot. But after the meeting, for some reason, instead of cutting and running, always before, at the end of the meeting, they'd say amen, I'd say adios, fill my cup and sink and leave. But I went and filled my cup, and Frank and I sat down, and in the middle of these old timers, it was about seven or eight of them, and they just sit and talked among themselves for about a half hour, 45 minutes. And I got more out of that than I did the whole meeting. Now, I remember going home and I was thinking, you know, maybe I found it now. I still didn't have a sponsor, but I was going to the meetings with these old timers and it was working for me. And this guy that was married to my cousin, show you what this program can do. He was a really cowboy. He was a whiskey drinking, bronc fighting, woman chasing, honky donkey. He had an ego. Oh God, it was that big. His sponsor said his ego was that big, and he said I had to knock it out of him and get him humbled before he could start teaching him. And Frank was doing pretty good. He was sober and working a good program, and he had a little store in Billings. He sold livestock supply and feed, cattle feed, and I had cows, so I was buying quite a lot of my stuff from him. I'd go in there, and him and I'd go to meetings and stuff. My cousin divorced him, and he married another lady, and that marriage was really a hard marriage. But she had five children, and he had four, and nine children there involved. And they were married a couple of years, and her oldest daughter got killed outside the town of Huntley. She was sober, but a drunk driver hit her. And about 2 years later, Frank's youngest daughter got killed down in Texas, the same kind of a deal. And through all of that, Frank kept staying sober. He never took a drink. And then his business went down. He lost his business. And he wound up working for the company he used to own. Like Carl, he used car salesman in the big book, you know. And he had so many things happen to him like that. And I asked, old Tom was his sponsor. And I asked Tom, I said, what can I do for Frank? He said, you can pray for him and you can be there for him and support him. But he said, Frank's tough. He said, he'll get through all these things. And he did it, get through them all. We opened up a little Huntley group about that time. And Frank lived across the street, so we let him open the door. We thought that would be a good job for him. And so he opened the door twice a week, took care of everything. And then he suffered a big heart attack, wound up in the hospital. And I went up to see him, and I said, you gonna make it? And he said, yeah, I'm gonna make it. One guy came in there and he said, doggone you, Frank, I went and got my suit cleaned. The least you could do is die. But Frank reached over and he took a key and he threw me the key and he said, that's the key to the Huntley Church. You open it. And I said, no, I haven't got time. I live 20 miles up and down. And he said, you're down there twice a week. You got to come 15 minutes earlier, stay 15 minutes later. That's 12 months. He said, don't argue. Just take the key and do it. Geez, I'm mad. And I thought, well, I'll open that church till he gets his heart deal straightened out. And then I'll throw the key back to him. Well, I got to open the church, and that's the greatest thing that ever happened to me for my AA program. I had to get there early and responsible, getting the coffee bought and the big books. And it was really great. And I did it. I was Santa Claus at their Christmas party every year. And then we had a picnic in the summertime, the Huntley group did. And it was just perfect for me. Then Frank had another heart attack. And doggone it, he survived that one. And then he developed diabetes, severe diabetes. He had to leave Montana. He couldn't take that cold temperature up there at all. And today Frank's living down in Kerrville, Texas. He married again to a neat gal, really a neat gal. And he last week celebrated his 80th birthday, and I believe his 30th AA birthday was just a little bit before that. So that shows you what working this program can do. And old Tom was his sponsor. And old Tom, was such a wonderful person. I'll talk about him a little bit more later on too. But he was Frank's sponsor, and Huntley Group is still going today. And we're not a big group at all. We have 12, 15 people, but it's going good. And I just everything I got or ever hoped to have, I owe to the AA program. It has been so great. That ninth step I swore up and down I'd never touch, I finally had to touch. I couldn't, I reached the point where I knew I had to start making amends. And the biggest demand I owed was to my mother. And she died about 7 months before I quit drinking. And my dad had died quite a while before her. And so I knew what I had to do was go to their grave. So one night, it was in December, I went down to the Huntley Cemetery and got down on my knees and prayed and made amends to my folks. And about that time, the moon came up, and you talk about lonesome, just you sitting out there in the cemetery making amends. Boy, it was really lonesome. I left a lot of tears there. But I went to the Huntley meeting that night, and I asked for a topic, and somebody said, well, what about making amends? If that isn't a God thing, yeah. It's just exactly what I needed. It was just perfect. And I had two other guys. I made a lot of amends to my brothers and everything, but there were two guys that I never saw, and I always, for years, I always thought about them. I owed them both in amends, and if I ever run into them, well, I ran into one at an auction sale, and I made an amend with him, and that was a monetary one. I owed him $500. I got that straightened around. And the other one of all the people who owe one to was a judge. I'd gone to school with him. And when he got out of school, he was a policeman down in Washington, and I got down there on a drunk, and he was trying to help me, and I really told him off. And I felt terrible about that. And I, at the funeral, I said, you got a little time? He said, sure. And him, we got a cup of coffee, and we sat down, and I told him about it, and I wanted to make that amend, and he said he'd completely forgotten about it. I said, well, I hadn't forgotten about it. I needed that. I'm doing it more for me than I was for him. And it... was such a relief. Making amends is such a great thing when you get it done. It's you put your pride aside and pray about it, and it's just wonderful when you can do those things. This old Tom, when old about old 25 years ago, I guess, I noticed my wife was. I guess the word would be acting confused. And my dad had suffered from Alzheimer's. And it, to me, it looked like it was the same thing. And my dad was lucky. He just had a big heart attack and hit the floor one Sunday night, and he was all over. Well, I took my wife to the doctor, and he said, she definitely has got Alzheimer's. He said, you're going to have to put her into a nursing home. And I said, no, I said, that's a long way down the road. Well, he said, you can keep her home for a while, but you're eventually going to have to put her into a nursing home. You can't be able to take care of her. So I took her home, and I was going to keep her there, and I kept her there for 3.5 years. When I started to take care of her, I thought, oh, how am I going to work this? I got this doggone cattle to take care of, and I got my AAA, and I don't know how I'm going to get to meetings or anything like that. But if I didn't make a meeting, if I missed two meetings at the most, I'd just look up and there'd be a pickup load of Elkies coming in the yard with a sack full of cookies, and we'd just have AA meeting right at the house. That's what AA did. My sponsor at that time was Big Bob. And he just rode herd on me to make double sure I got meetings. And Bob called me one Easter, and he said, what are you doing for Easter dinner? I said, oh, I don't know, kind of looking at a can of Spams about all. He said, don't do it. He said, I'll be out. I got a bucket of chicken and a newcomer. So he showed up with a bucket of chicken and a newcomer, and we had a meeting there, and it was just perfect. Once again, he saved me, you know, from that. That's the way it worked. AA was there for me all the way. One time we had a whole bunch of cows to pregnancy test. And the vet told me, he says, you're going to need a crew of 8 men. Well, I told Bob, I said, I got to get a crew put together. And he says, how many people do you need? And I said, well, he wants 8. And I said, there's myself and a neighbor and you. I said, I need 5 more. He said, I'll get them. So the day we pregnancy tested, he showed up the pickup load of alcoholics. But they were sober alcoholics. They were ready to go to work. And we went through those cattle like Grant went through Richmond. I mean, we really did. We got done. The vet got me aside, and he said, that crew you got is as good as any crew I've ever worked with. And I wanted to tell him so bad, yeah, 7 out of 8 of us are hardcore alcoholics. I didn't, but I sure wanted to. That just shows you the love and support you can get from your A group. Why it's so important to have a home group and where people know you. That's critical. And my wife's disease just kept getting a little worse, a little worse, a little worse. Finally, I took her to the doctor. The doctor told the nurse to stay with her. He took me in his office. He said, okay, the time has come to put her in the nursing home. I said, no, I can take care of her. He said, no, you can't. He said, you go look in the mirror and you're gray, your face is. He said, you're setting yourself up for a big heart attack. And if you die, how much help are you going to be to her then? Down deep, I knew he was right. But geez, I didn't want to put her in the nursing home. But finally, I had no choice. I talked to her and talked to her, and she agreed to go in. I took her in, and we had a horrible time that night getting her to settle down, to get her to sleep. Finally, she did. I walked outside, and I'm standing out there, and I thought, what the heck is today? Is something special about today? And then it dawned on me. It was our 25th wedding anniversary that day. And I'm leaving her in there alone, and I'm going home. Boy, I just felt horrible. And thank God for AA. I made a vow. I'm going to go to an AA meeting either before or after I go see her. Preferably after I see her. That's when I needed one. One night I didn't get to go in. I didn't get to go to a meeting because I was there at the nursing home till 11. I walked outside and the only thing out there was my pickup. And I walked over by it and I looked and there was a bar across the street with the old neon lights flashing. And I thought, my Lord, what am I trying to prove? Why don't I go get a double shot and a beer? It would sure take the edge off of this thing. I stood by my pickup and said a serenity prayer and got in and drove home. I didn't have to go. Thank God for our bar and for the program that got me through it. And to show how cunning and baffling and powerful this thing is, one day in the summertime, I went in to see her. I drove by the nursing home. The parking lot was full. So I parked over by the bar and got out. And I thought, well, if I'm using their parking lot, I should go get me a can of pop from them. So I did. I went to the nursing home. The second day I went, I didn't even look to see if that parking lot was full. Yeah, that's how baffling and cunning that thing is. Then I walked in the bar and got a can of pop. The third day, I didn't even look at the parking lot, went in the bar, got my can of pop. Instead of walking out the door, I sat down and started visiting with the barmaid. And I looked down the bar, and there's an old boy down there with about 6 beers too many in him, and looked around behind me, and there was old sad country music coming out of the jukebox. It was nice and cool in there. I thought, man, this is great. There's only one thing wrong. Who in the hell wants this can of Pepsi? I want a beer. Boy, that just scared me half to death. I bailed off that stool and stomped out the door, and I thought, you know there's a pop machine in the nursing home. You know where it's at. But old Mr. Alcohol was just setting me up. Just, I swear, when I go to bed at night, Mr. Alcohol says, okay, you've got another day, and that's fine. I'm going to go over here in the corner and do push-ups all night, sir. I'll help you tomorrow. If you stumble, I'll catch you. Don't worry. That is the cunning and baffling and powerful part of that, of the disease for me. And my wife was in the nursing home 3.5 years. And I went in one morning to see her, and she wasn't at where she always ate breakfast. And they always had her at the same table to keep her from getting so confused. And I thought, boy, that doesn't look good. And I started to walk down the hall to her room, and the lady was walking up the hall, and she saw me and stopped and started crying. And that lady had been working with my wife, and so I thought, man, this is serious. And I walked up to her, and she hugged me, and she told me, she said, I got your wife up and got her dressed, but we couldn't get her to eat anything. She refuses to eat. So we put her back to bed, and she said, they want to see you down in the office. So I went down there. And the guy said, she has a living will, is that correct? And I said, yes. He said, do you want to enforce it? I said, well, who appointed me God? He said, you got power of attorney and you're the husband. You've got to make the call. So I said, well, can I have a half hour? And he said, take all the time you want, but let me know. So I went out and got in my pickup and just sat there and cried for quite a while. Then I thought, I know what I got to do, what I've been taught to do, and that's to pray. So I prayed about it. I picked my cell phone up. I made 3 phone calls, one to each of her daughters and one to her brother. And the phone rang twice each time and they picked it up. But that, you can never catch those people. Each, that instance, that day, they were all right there. That's got to be another God thing. And all 3 of them told me exactly the same thing, that it was time to let go and let her go. And so I went back in and told them that we'll enforce the living will. And I don't know if any of you people have ever been involved with hospice, but they're a tremendous organization. There was a lady in the office, she said she would absolutely guarantee me there would be a person in that room 24 hours a day until she passes away. And then she says, we'll call you if you're not here. And she said, we want you here during the day, but we want you to go home at night and you gotta start getting some rest. And I said, how long is this gonna take? She says, as a rule, it's 2 weeks. I said, well, but they live. Well, my wife's lucky. She got to pass on after 8 days. And the phone rang at 4:45 in the morning, and the minute it rang, I knew what it was, and it was, she just passed away. And my grandson was staying with me then, and I went in and woke him up, and we built a pot of coffee and drank it, and I said, we got to go into the funeral home and finish. I already started making arrangements, had a casket picked out, and some of the pallbearers, and we went in and got that done. Then I told him when we left, I said, I really think there's going to be a lot of people at this funeral. I said, I'm sure everybody tells you that, but I really feel there will be. He said, don't worry, this room holds 200 people, for crying out loud. You don't have to worry about anything. Well, the day of the funeral, that doggone room was jam-packed to the rafters. They had chairs set up everywhere. Finally, they opened up the kitchen and dumped about 40, 50 people in there. And I looked at that crowd, and it was just like looking at all of you alcoholics. There were alcoholics everywhere. One alcoholic was down in South California when he heard about that she passed away, and he drove almost straight through to get there in time for the funeral. That shows how much love there is in this program. And there were just people everywhere. One alcoholic came to me, and he said, do you remember me? And I said, sure, I do. Your name's Warren. But I said, I haven't seen you for 15 years. And he says, I know it. But he said, I read about it in the paper, and I just had to come. And then I looked up as the funeral was about to start, and who stumbled in the door but old Tom. Aww. At that time, he was 88, and he had a walker, and he was pushing that in front of him, and he had an alcoholic on each side of him in case he tipped one way or the other. The guy, he came up to me, hugged me, told me, love me. I started crying, he started crying. I thought, oh my God, this thing hasn't even started. I've got a cowboy up here. And boy, I said, I took a deep breath and swallowed hard and said the serenity prayer and went and sat down, and we got through the funeral. And it was just beautiful. And old Tom, his wife, Pat, well, before that, this big Bob and I went up there one fall and took him and his wife out of their nursing home and drove them around the country to show them the crops and everything, just to get them some fresh air, and they really enjoyed that. And then his wife died shortly after that, and then old Tom, he finally moved out to Oregon to be with his daughter. And this Christmas, I think it was a year ago, I sent him a Christmas card, and I wrote in there, told him I loved him, and I thanked him for being there for me, and told him how much he meant to me, and he died about 3-4 months after I mailed that card. I'm so grateful that I got to do that. There was another old alcoholic in Billings, an old-timer, was a lawyer, and they called him Blessed Bob. And he was another one. He had 50-some years, and his son was bringing him to meetings, and he was in a wheelchair. This is about 6 months ago, and after a meeting one night, he was wheeled his wheelchair out by his son's car, waiting for his son to was visiting with some people. And I walked over to him and thanked him for how much he'd done for me in my early sobriety, and told him I loved him. He died either two or three days later. I'm so grateful that I got to make peace with those two old guys. And the AA is just so full of love and understanding like that. And it's just absolutely fantastic. About 6 months after my wife passed away, I was home, and I looking at the calendar, it was our wedding anniversary. And I was okay with it. It didn't bother me, and I was doing all right. But at 3:30, the phone rang. It was Bill F. from the Huntley Group. He said, "How are you doing today?" And I said, "I'm doing great." Well, he says, "I know it's your anniversary. I just want to check and make sure." And I said, "Well, I can't hear you very good, Bill. Where are you calling from?" He said, "Indonesia." Halfway around the world.
Wow.
I knew the company he worked for had interest over there, and every so often they'd send him over there on business. And he, if it was in the 3:30 in the afternoon, where I was, it's probably 3:30 in the morning over there, and there's an Alki getting up in the middle of the night to call another Alki just to make sure he's all right. I had two brothers and a sister living in Billings. And none of them called me. They were so busy with their own lives, they never even thought about it, you know. But another alcoholic did. And today, I'm so grateful for this program. I'm so grateful for when I was born. Because when I sobered up, the big book was open and the door was open, the coffee pot was on, and the old timer was sitting there ready to start hammering on me. I'm so grateful, these two gentlemen's pictures down there, that they were there. Look at the lives they've saved and everything. It's absolutely unreal. I always thought that the worst thing that possibly happened to me is being an alcoholic. Today I know it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I've got this wonderful life, and I enjoy life so much. And about 2 years after my wife passed away, and I started going out with this lady. She said it was 4 years. I thought it was 40 when we were married. Anyway, her and I, last year, we got to go down to Australia. And it just happened that it was my 33rd birthday when we lived in Melbourne. Well, Big Bob knew a man who knew a man who knew a man down there in Melbourne. And I got a phone number and called this guy up, and he came up to the hotel and got me, took me to a meeting down in Melbourne. And they're about the same as we are, a few things different, but it's basically the same thing. One thing was different. They asked me to get up and say a few words, and I said, "My name's Don, and I'm an alcoholic." And 50 Aussies all yelled, "G'day, mate!" About gave me a heart attack. But that's the beautiful part of this. And we're going to go on a cruise here in a couple of weeks, and the cruise ships have got AA meetings all over. Mm-hmm. We took a cruise ship to Alaska, and I asked a gal there, I said, "Are AA meetings on the ship?" She said, "I don't think so." She said, "Not unless it would have anything to do with a Dr. Bob." Well, I said, "Well, if he's got a buddy named Bill W." Yeah. I got to go on cruise ship meetings, and today AA is a big, big part of my life. I love AA. I go to about 4 to 5 meetings a week, try to hit at least 4, and it's just so important. I sponsor some people, and that can be very rewarding, and it can also be very, very frustrating. I've watched so many people die and get killed, and so many suicides of young people, and it's such a horrible disease, so cunning, baffling, and powerful. And all I'm given is a daily reprieve. I can't, like we talk a lot of these guys, summertime, they haven't got time, AA, they got to go fishing and things like that. They think you can come in the wintertime for 5 meetings a week and then use some of those weeks or days off in the summertime when you can go fishing, you know. It doesn't work that way at all. But this is a wonderful, wonderful thing. I don't know if any of you, I'm sure some of you remember the name of Charlie Russell. He's a famous painter, cowboy painter up in Montana. I was reading about him. He was a terrible alcoholic, and of course there was no AA. And he was sitting around the campfire, a bunch of cowboys were one night, and one of them pulled out a jug of whiskey and was passing it around, and it came to him. He says, I just can't drink it. He said, I cannot handle it. But he said, I can hold it and smell it. And he was sitting there holding that bottle of whiskey and sniffing it. What kind of sobriety could that be, you know? That would just be horrible. That's why I say I'm so glad Dr. Bob and Bill W. were here before me. And got a little time left. I guess I'd about talk to myself out here, I guess. I sure appreciate you guys for asking me back here. When I was drinking, they never asked me to come back anywhere. Yeah. Change.
Yeah, money.
Appreciate you for letting me speak, and thank you very much.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Don. For a guy that was called Get Wood, I really think we had a great speaker here tonight. So. By the way, there's flyers for our fall roundup on the back table, so I hope you start thinking about that too. But there's going to be an ice cream social right on the other side of that curtain there in just a moment, and I'm going to guess there's lots of different flavors, and there's a dance as soon as they kind of set things up right here, so stick around and have some fun. Other than that, let's close with the Lord's Prayer, and thank you for being here. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.